This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll chat a bit about National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week. Then Jessica Rosegard discusses the upcoming mayoral election with the Advocate's Stephanie Grace. And later in the show, we'll share another story from Bring Your Own. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. But first, here's one of NOLA Life's stories. School desegregation was a major turning point of the civil rights movement, especially here in New Orleans. In this edition of NOLA Life Stories, we meet Tessie Williams. She was one of McDonough 3, the young African-American girls who integrated their elementary school in the Ninth Ward. Tessie describes her memory of that first morning on the way to school.
When we first went to McDonough 19, my dad always said that he was excited about it. He was glad for the opportunity, but he didn't realize what he was putting me into. He didn't realize it was going to be all of, you know, this big, all over the nation, all over the world. And to see, we got hate mail, we got phone calls, and it was just crazy. You know, there were people that, because we lived in a mixed neighborhood at that time, Lower Ninth Ward was a mixed neighborhood. And there were people that you knew and you spoke to, and they spoke to you today, that day. They don't have anything to do with you. My daddy used to ride, because he didn't have a car, but he used to get a ride with this man. After that, he went and picked him up.
One of these mornings, you're gonna run up singing.
And he told me, the only thing he told me I remember is that once we get out this car, give me your hand and look straight ahead. And don't you worry about a thing. I'm here. I'm here to protect you. I'm here.
Morning, nothing will hold.
Okay, like I said, that day I got up. My mama had my clothes made, you know, laid out, ready to go. And like I said, I remember the marshals coming. When we got to the school, all I could see was this crowd of people. And I seriously thought it was Mardi Gras. Because, of course, there were no other children in school. Well, they were at first. When we got there, they were. But all of a sudden, you saw children disappearing. And then after that, it was just the three of us for an entire year.
Sometime I feel like a motherless child.
And the thing about it is, my history teacher that was in 11th grade knew about this. And nobody else ever knew that I knew of, because I never mentioned it. But he knew about it. So he gave me this assignment, the Brown versus the Board of Education. And he said, what you have to do is work down to where this decision affect present time. And that's when I did studying and went to the library and all, and I'm like, huh. You know, I saw my name, I saw my pictures, and I'm like, so this is what this was all about. And I went to him and I asked him, I said, did you know about this? And he said, yeah, I knew. Yeah. I said, that's what I wanted you to see. Because you never mentioned it. You never said anything about it. So maybe you didn't feel how important a part you played in the civil rights movement. So I wanted to let you know. I didn't realize that we had done anything. I understand the importance, but I don't feel that important. You know what I'm saying? And I remember my daddy's friend telling me, girl, you were the first. You were the first. Can you understand that? And I'm like, well, okay. You know, okay.
This NOLA Life Stories interview was conducted by Mark Cave for the Historic New Orleans Collection and produced for WWNO by Sarah Holtz. This week is National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week, and two local nonprofits have teamed up for a dine-out at several restaurants across the city. Joining me now to discuss ways to meet the needs of the homeless in our community is Melissa Tyler with the New Orleans Women and Children's Shelter and Sarah Parks, Executive Director of Grace at the Greenlight. Ladies, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi.
Melissa, tell us what the New Orleans Women and Children's Shelter is doing to break the cycle of homelessness in the city.
We take a multi-pronged wraparound approach to providing services for the homeless people that we serve. We understand that usually there are a number of factors that are contributing to homelessness, and we need to address several of those to actually end it for those families.
Now, Sarah, Grace at the Greenlight has a similar mission, but it's a bit different. Tell us a bit about those programs that you guys have.
Yeah, so we run programs to help the street homeless here in New Orleans, and we have two different programs, one where we provide meals and meet the basic needs of food, water, and community, and also we help reunite the homeless with their families if that's an option.
Those are some great programs to have. And Melissa, I know that you guys have similar programs. And one in particular is called the Case Management Program. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Case management is a term that basically means we will bring a person in and develop a case. We will develop goals with the person individually, with their children, and with them as a family. And that could include any number of things from finding a new or better job to accessing resources in the community for health care. We have about 60 community partners that we work with to provide those services.
How many women and children does your shelter see on an average?
On an average, we've got about 50 residents at any given time, and we've served 1,600 people over our 10-year history.
That's great. In observance of National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week, your two organizations have collaborated for a dine-out. Sarah, tell us a bit more about that.
Yes, so we have a bunch of different partner restaurants that have joined with us, and they are partnering with us to donate part of the proceeds of their meals to both the New Orleans Women's Shelter as well as Grace at the Greenlight.
I mean, the city is full of a bunch of restaurants. So can you throw out a few of them?
So we started off the week with Blaze Pizza, Buffalo Wild Wings, and Dat Dog, and then Ruby Slipper, which is a breakfast favorite. And those restaurants, you know, they didn't have to do this. They chose to give back to their community to benefit our organizations and to impact the homeless. So they're great. I love all of their food.
So what restaurants can folks go out to tonight?
Tonight we have fine dining at Fogo de Chao. There's a special package, the full Churrasco experience. We're really excited about that. And tomorrow they can visit Chipotle and Metairie on Veterans Memorial Boulevard. And Saturday is actually not a restaurant. It's a grocery store. The New Orleans Co-op, which is very much about community, is donating 10% of their proceeds from the day's sales.
So both of your organizations have been fighting homelessness for years now. Have you noticed any changes in regards to homelessness in New Orleans? Like, are there more folks on the streets or off the streets? What do you have to say about that, Sarah?
We see many different changes in the homeless population. It can be very cyclical and go up and down. I would say in the past few years, we've seen the city and all of the partner agencies that work with the homeless make great strides in helping meet the basic needs of the homeless, as well as providing mental health services and addiction services and permanent housing for the homeless. So we have done a great job in getting the chronically homeless off the streets, and as well as veterans Now, because we're a transient city, we see many new homeless faces every day. When we serve breakfast, I see about 5 to 10 new people every morning. So it's a continual issue that we just need to continue to address and keep doing what we're doing to help those out there.
If we have any listeners out there who are interested in volunteering with either one of your organizations, how could they do that?
For folks who are interested in volunteering with us, the best way to contact us is by phone. Our phone number is 504-522-9340. We have an awesome staff person named Sydney who will talk with you about what it is that you want to do and match you with the best opportunity for volunteering.
That was Melissa Tyler with the New Orleans Women and Children's Shelter, and Sarah Parks is the executive director of Grace at the Green Light. Ladies, thanks so much for what you do, and thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Dine Out during National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week goes on until Saturday. Find a list of restaurants and more information at nowcs.org. The New Orleans mayoral election comes to a close this Saturday. WWNO's Jessica Rosegard checked in with Stephanie Grace from The Advocate to talk about the issues at play in the campaign.
Stephanie Grace, columnist for The Advocate, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We have an election this Saturday. Finally, the runoff feels like it's been a long time.
It does, yes.
University of New Orleans had a poll out earlier this week with some numbers leading up to the election, and throughout the runoff, LaToya Cantrell still has a fairly comfortable lead over Desiree Charbonnet.
And, you know, she did at the primary vote, it was the difference was about 9 points between the two, and here the margin is 11%. Really, every poll we've heard of during this period mm-hmm. has been double digits. So this isn't really a surprise.
Mm-hmm. You know, this runoff period got kind of ugly.
It did. It was really dominated by one story, one attack from the Charbonnet campaign against LaToya Cantrell about her use of her city credit card as a member of the city council. And there are charges that she maybe didn't document as well as she could have, mm-hmm. although she was not required to. And there was a chunk of money that she paid back, mm-hmm. including a big chunk during right when the campaign was starting. So what Cantrell says is that we did that in abundance of caution. We went through and paid back anything that might have been questionable. Mm-hmm. What the Charbonnet camp says is that's kind of evidence of a guilty conscience almost. Mm-hmm. And they've really floated the idea that this could be criminal, which it's interesting. And it's an attack that I don't think has stuck and perhaps is a little heavy-handed and maybe has created some suspicion of Cantrell, but maybe also some sympathy for her, because there's a lot of gray in this. Mm-hmm. There are certainly things where she was somewhat careless and some charges that maybe should not have been city business, but there were some that were reimbursements for travel right. that other people reimbursed her for. It's a little hard to tell. And when we got the records from the rest of the city council, her spending really wasn't that different from some of the other members, mm-hmm. how she used her city credit card. And of course, each council member has a budget and she didn't go over it. None of them did. And so it ended up being a real topic of conversation, but mm-hmm. it didn't seem to change the dynamic much.
And speaking to her campaign staff earlier this week, you know, they said that they really felt like the credit card issue took away from talking about campaign issues during this runoff.
Right. It's almost the only thing that happened during yeah. the period of the runoff mm-hmm. since the primary. And so it really has dominated conversation. Some Cantrell supporters have looked for things to throw at Charbonnet. They haven't really stuck. Things like a homestead exemption, which on a house that she shares with her ex-husband, that seems to be proper. But, you know, I think it does go to the fact that this campaign almost feels like it's not about that much. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what people are picking up. So they have been talking about issues. They've been going to forums left and right. Mm-hmm. They haven't said that much that's new about issues. And there really aren't that many places where you can point and say, Charbonnet stands for this, Cantrell stands for this.
Right.
There are a few. And actually, The Advocate ran a pretty good chart on Monday outlining some of them. Mm-hmm. And it's things like Cantrell would get rid of traffic cameras right away. Charbonnet would wait until they figured out how to replace the revenue and also the kind of crime fighting mm-hmm. or the, you know, the enforcement element of it. You know, there is a list, but it's not, they're not huge issues, and they're not things where they've had a real debate where one has kind of said, I want to do this, and the other one has said, no, this is why that's wrong. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there was some space to fill, and this is what filled it. And yeah. It's been something that I think has turned a lot of people off, frankly, from both of them.
We've talked about that a lot in our newsroom, too, about how after every debate, it seems like there's not stark differences between them
right.
on policy.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess then there was this void.
Right. So when that happens, then the campaign becomes about other things. It becomes about trust, in this case, mm-hmm. became a big issue. It becomes about style. It becomes about who's an insider and who's an outsider and which would you prefer. It definitely becomes about who is around the candidates. That's been a big mm-hmm. issue in Charbonnet's case. And you know, people supporting Cantrell have really gotten some traction out of pointing out some of the real political insiders around
her. Leon Cannizzaro,
the district attorney, who's mm-hmm. you know, a very divisive figure right now right. in city politics. Some of the political operatives, a guy named Bill Schultz, who's close to Cannizzaro, Ike Spears, Blair Boutte. These are names that maybe people inside politics know who are kind of movers and shakers. Mm-hmm. And this has been a big part of the discussion, but I think the underlying idea behind it is, how independent is Charbonnet?
Mm-hmm.
And Cantrell is someone who did not have a lot of endorsements to start off, who really is seen as her own person, I think.
Right.
Came up through grassroots neighborhood activity, you know, doesn't shy away from fights with other mm-hmm. politicians,
yeah.
including the mayor.
New Orleanians, in terms of, you know, undecided voters right now and people who are kind of turned off by the campaign, one of these two candidates is going to win. And they're kind of coming into office with people who don't really trust them. So how could they overcome some of these issues?
Well, it's going to be really interesting. I think whoever wins should do something that makes a statement early on. That would be my advice. And we're going to be entering a very strange period because, if you remember, we used to have these mayoral elections in the winter, spring, and now we have them in the fall. And in this case, only this year, that means that we're going to have a really long transition period mm-hmm. when we're going to have essentially two mayors incoming and outgoing. So I think, you know, if you're LaToya Cantrell, you appoint someone as a chief of staff or a CAO who is a good manager of money.
Mm-hmm.
The way she can put it behind her, I think, is to say, I'm going to have very strict controls on how I handle money. This is not an issue. Don't worry about it. And with Charbonnet, I think there will be real signals in who she appoints, too, if she's elected.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is it somebody from that kind of insider class, or is it maybe somebody out of the box, which would, I think, maybe help overcome some of those doubts?
Stephanie Grace, thanks again for joining me. This will all be, I guess, resolved come November 18th, this Saturday.
Yes. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Thanks.
And we're back with more BYO. This story was told on September 28th at the CAC and later produced by Lane Kaplan Levinson. The theme of the evening was The Thing Is, and here sisters Susan and Anne describe their single most important family heirloom, a New Orleans daiquiri Mardi Gras medallion.
Okay, so to kind of preface this story, right after Katrina, when we got at our house, the very first thing I did before rebuilding was write a quote over the doorway. And it was, "Frivolity is the refusal of human beings to suffer." And that was a quote that my sister Anne told me from a theater critic, John Lars. So the whole idea of frivolity being really important is one of our family creeds or family mottos. So this story, it's actually the daiquiri medallion, not bead, but medallion. And we don't really know where it came from or when it came from, but being Mardi Gras bead archaeologists, the medallion, as well as the daiquiri, both had its genesis in the 80s, the 1980s. So we're assuming this bead came from the 80s. Our father, who owned this heirloom, probably probably found it on one of his Friday wanderings at a daiquiri shop in the French Quarter.
Right, but to get to the get to the 80s and to get to the Friday afternoon wanderings in the French Quarter, we had to kind of go way back to his origins. And my father, Eric Gislason, he was a very driven, ambitious, brilliant attorney. And right out of college, he married a wonderful woman, Janet Gislason. He went to Georgetown Law. Had a full-time job while getting his law degree, and he had three children while he was getting his law degree. So he graduated, kept being ambitious, kept having children, until he finally had 8 kids within about 8 years. And he got his dream job down here in the 70s, which was he was the youngest strike force chief for the Department of Justice, and they fought organized crime in the French Quarter and in New Orleans. And so he would be fighting the mafia in the French Quarter during the day and go home to his 8 kids in the evening. And so I'm sure, like, by the time the 80s rolled around and, the jobs got better and better, the houses got bigger, and we ended up in the 80s in, like, this big house on State Street. Most of us were adolescents at the time. It was crazy. There were, like, 8 teenagers in this big house on State Street. And so after these long weeks of working, rewarding himself, he wouldn't, like, kick back at his big house that he worked so hard for with, like, a single malt scotch or a fine Kentucky bourbon. He would get a freaking 32-ounce, 190-octane daiquiri with 2 extra shots of Everclear in it.
And that's how he would prepare to go grocery shopping. So... And one of the things about, like, being in a large family is I always felt, even as a very young girl, like the stress of having to provide for 10 people. And so to go grocery shopping, he would get his 190 octane. And I imagine him, he was 6'3", a striking man, very handsome, walking down the aisles of a grocery store with his girl drink in his hand. And I was always kind of incongruous.
I was kind of embarrassed by it because, you know, back in the 80s, it was the drinking age was 18. So, of course, we were all going to bars when we were, like, 14. So as soon as we could get our license, we would have to go down to the daiquiri place at the Riverbend, and we would pick up his 190 octane with 2 extra shots of Everclear, and it was kind of embarrassing, and I kind of didn't even like daiquiris, except that when I went off to college, and for Christmas, he would greet me at the end of the terminal with a 20-ounce Cajun eggnog that was so delicious, and I knew I was home.
Yeah, but the funny part of that story is that never happened to me. Like, I don't even... Like, I don't think he even ever picked me up at the airport, which is kind of...
That's because I was the favorite of all 8 children. That's why...
But the other thing that was really special, that coming home for Christmas from college, was that he would take you to lunch at the Rib Room in the French Quarter on Royal Street. And one of the reasons it was so special is because when there are so many kids in the family, you never, ever, ever get one-on-one time with your parent. And so that was a time where you would sit at this beautiful environment with these giant windows, floor to ceiling, looking out at Royal Street, looking at the parade of humanity. And he would tell you stories. He would tell you stories about his upbringing, about prosecuting Jim Garrison, his present cases. He would always have these really bizarre cases like chicken coops in Cairo. He would give them these funny names. And then after this really sophisticated meal, we would go out and get daiquiris.
But the bead, to get back to the medallion.
Yeah.
To get back to the medallion. So the medallion was something that there was this exclusive male-only Lundi Gras meal that they would have, Lundi Gras lunch at the Rib Room. My brothers went, my husband went, but it was all male. And that went on for years and years. It was this kind of raucous thing. And then my father got very ill in about 2010, and we just kind of invited ourselves. It had gotten a little less robust, and we're like, we're just going to go. And we went, and so, we're in this beautiful dining room, marble walls and everything, and vaulted ceilings, and my dad takes out this cheesy, messed-up medallion, and the guys start passing it around kind of solemnly.
We're talking lawyers, bankers, yeah, businessmen, like, as a table
like,
of men.
We're like, what is this? And they wouldn't tell us, like, what it was or what was going on, and they still wouldn't. Like, to this day, I've been, like, texting his lawyer friends, and they're very mum about it.
So we don't really know the background. So fast forward 2 years later, our father passes away, and I was always told that this is our family heirloom. This is what we get, period. And that it was in a safety deposit box somewhere and it'll be taken care of.
I never heard any of that. I don't know where she got the safety deposit box from.
So he passes away, he dies, and all of the kids, we all go to his office, and we're cleaning out his desk, getting the family photos. And in one of the drawers, our sister Kristen finds the medallion in a pile of lottery tickets, which that was his retirement plan, the lottery tickets. And so it was, he died January 13th, which was, of course, carnival season had already started, so we decided to have a Lindy Gras lunch without him. And so it was all the kids, our mother, and we would each wear the bead and tell a story of our father, just like a little memory. And the story that I told was I had my first child at home, actually the house that we grew up in on State Street, in my parents' bed, and 12 hours natural childbirth, give birth to this baby, excruciating pain, and my dad walks in the door and he says, "That's the easy part." And he was.
But we still, no matter who's at the table, whether they knew dad or not, we pass it around. And it's kind of the spirit of dad. This is a worthless little trinket, but it embodies kind of who he was. It's kind of, he rejected sophistication. He rejected so much about the status. He was a very complicated guy.
So well, you remember when you compared it to, like, on Lindy Gras, you have, back in the day, it was Proteus, Comus, Momus, and they would all parade around in their opulence with these...
with the medallions.
Real medallions, these and gold medallions, and they represented these old crews. Our dad hated what those old crews represented because he was for the people.
And this, for us, kind of symbolizes a more kind of a democratic bent that dad never let go of, the kind of the street-level culture of New Orleans, which is... New Orleans original daiquiris.
Amen.
That BYO was in partnership with Project Object and the Stax Bookstore, and those sisters won with this story that evening. The next BYO is tomorrow, November 17th, as part of Court 13's Always for Pleasure Festival. The theme is Pleasure and Pain. More information at bringyourownstories.com. That's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to Janae at WWNO.org. That's JANAE at WWNO.org. Visit our website to check out previous shows and be sure to catch us next week. Right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodeau Houma. Thanks for joining us. Underwriting programming on WWNO New Orleans Public Radio is a great way to support this station. And it's also a very effective way to reach informed, civic-minded, and educated adults in the New Orleans region with information about your business, service, or organization. Find out how WWNO 89.9 FM can help grow your business by emailing underwriting@wwno.org.